the people that I see that are really genuinely joyful and happy are those who are grateful. They're thankful every day for the opportunities and they give back. Don't get caught up in the noise around you. There is a lot of noise that is distraction and is just investment pornography. Leave it alone.
Welcome back to the Next Peak Podcast. I'm your host, Clint Herndon, and this is the podcast where we help you redefine success and achieve goals that are actually important to you based on research and real life stories. Today, I'm joined by my friend and top 100 financial advisor, Kimberly Foss, who is the president and founder of Empyrean Wealth Management here in the greater Sacramento area. She's also the author of the best-selling book, Wealthy by Design. Kimberly, thanks for joining me.
Thank you for inviting me. It's great to be on.
So I want to ask you, in building your business, where did that dream come from? Where did the idea of Empyrean come from? And how did you get started with that?
I think it really when I was a kid. I come from very humble beginnings. My dad was a carpenter. My mother was an Avon lady. And I was the youngest of six children. So we didn't have a whole lot. We weren't poverty, but we certainly didn't have a whole lot. So I think that I tapped into my passion pretty early on. And I remember wanting to buy a pair of designer jeans when I was 11 years old. I really wanted these DoorDash jeans. I know I'm dating myself here, but I wanted these DoorDash jeans. Then they were $38. And my mom said, okay, you can have them, but you have to go earn the money. And I'm like, okay, well, that's fine. How do I do this? And she says, well, you can do odd jobs around the house, what have you. Well, we needed a rock wall built in the backyard. So I ended up getting paid $1 an hour. My mom paid me $1 an hour. My mom and dad paid me $1 an hour to build this rock wall. So 38 hours later, I had this beautiful rock wall and I was so proud. And I went in and showed my mom and my dad and everything. I said, okay, so can I have my money? And she said, oh, I forgot to tell you. You need to actually have double that so that you have money in your bank account for a rainy day in the event that something happens. So when you get another $38, then you can go buy your jeans. And I'm like, kind of like that information up front, mom. But yeah, that was kind of my first exposure to capitalism and also for saving for a rainy day. That was such a pivotal point in my life about wealth and about money, because my mother really instilled that, look, at have enough in the sidelines so that if something happens, you aren't having to dip into, and today would be credit cards or something like that. So I was really grateful for that. I was mad at the time, really mad at the time, but it was a great life lesson that started in my early days. So that kind of set the tone for my wealth management.
And so when you get this idea of like, hey, this is how you build money or how you earn money and work hard for it, how did that translate? What did you do? What were your next steps? Did you go to college? Did you go work for somebody that kind of got you additionally on this path?
Right. So I, was the youngest of six, and nobody in my family at the time, as you can imagine, my dad wasn't in the union or anything, was just a carpenter, like Jesus. Right. So We didn't have a whole lot of money. So I was the youngest, and my parents did kind of say, hey, you got the brightest of your dad and your mom. You probably are going to go to college. So I just set my sights and realizing that college was the ticket to freedom. So if I had a college degree, I could have more doors open. So I went ahead and kind of just educated myself on college and what I needed to go to get to school. Did that, worked my way through college, graduated in 4 years I started out as an architect, then a computer science major, and then moved to business, marketing, and finance. And graduated with that with about 10 grand in debt, which was kind of a lot at that time. But then about halfway through college, just realized like I got exposed to the markets and I went, this makes sense, because as a woman, and of course, back then even had so much more barriers to entry than today. And also being blonde and blue eyed. I mean, it was just like I had everything against me. Right. So but I got exposed to the brokerage industry and said, hey, this is an idea where if I worked really hard and did the right thing and worked really hard and did the right thing, there's no ceiling for me. right? So they can't treat me any differently than a gentleman or anybody else. So I thought this was kind of a great idea. So I went and I just pounded on the door to a local brokerage firm in the school where the town where I was going to school. And for like 6 months, they didn't give me a job. They just didn't have it. It became a joke that I kept going in there. And they finally referred me to another firm in a different city and I got the job. So I learned everything about the brokerage business for 2 years and worked there so that when I was 21 and graduated, I actually had experience and they couldn't turn me down for that. Because I knew they were going to turn me down because I was young. I didn't even have a stock when I got hired by Merrill Lynch, right? So I got hired on there and then learned in the business. Really, it was great because I learned the dark side is what I call the dark side of the business. There's no offense to Mother Merrill or anything like that, but I just learned that there was two sides to the business. And about halfway through my career there, which is about 3 years, I said, okay, we're not going to do it this way. I'm going to go out on my own and I'm going to do it my way because I know in my heart that's the right way to do business. And if I'm successful 20 years down the road, I'll be moving and shaking and growing. If I'm not, then the markets will tell me that I won't and I'll figure out something else. And so I went out on my own at 25 and looked back.
Wow. So early.
Yeah, that does seem pretty early nowadays, right?
The great thing about that story is it's encouraging because I think people think they have to have 20 years of experience before they go start their own business. I think a lot of us, at least in today's day and age, we want the instant success, right? Yeah. We come up with a dream and we're excited about it and we can't wait to do it. And we're disappointed when it doesn't happen overnight.
Right.
I'm curious, when you started at 25 and you started your business, was it that easy that you just turned on the open sign and all of a sudden, instant success? What kind of challenges did you face and what did you do to keep going when those challenges hit?
I think the more difficult for today's society is that we're so instant gratification, Clint. Everything is instant. And even I see what my attention span is not as long as it used to be. So back then we didn't have Instagram and we didn't have that. So I think there was a bit of an easier for us to start out. But you know, the bottom line was that it was really hard. You opened up the doors. I didn't have any clients. I didn't have any connections. I wasn't a trust fund baby. I didn't have anything. So I joined the Rotary Club. I made connections. I worked hard. I did the right thing. I worked hard. I did the right thing. And I worked hard. And I just kept working at it. This is the thing, is like, people, if you talk to anybody who's successful, it's like they were doing all the things that they liked and they didn't like, even when they didn't want to do it. I mean, talk to athletes. When they're tired, they don't make it to the Olympics because they were tired, that they just pushed through. Mm-hmm. And I think that's the key for today. It's like, don't give up, just push through. If you give up, you have failed. If you don't give up, you'll never will fail. Because you will finally persevere through it. So that was a big thing for me. And another thing was that being in the financial field, if I listened to the people and one of my professors in college told me that when I thought that I wanted to be a broker, he looked at me and said, well, you can't. And I said, excuse me, why? And he said, well, because you're a woman and you're blonde and you're attractive and like people aren't going to take you seriously. And I'm like, okay. So I was respectful outside. I said, okay, thank you for that information. But inside I'm going, explicit words. I'm like, okay, you watch me. That's all I needed was like that right there was like, oh, you watch, bring it on. You know? So I'm like, that's all I needed to kind of persevere through it. Not to prove him wrong, but just to be able to know that I can do this. And anybody could do this. I wasn't born with a silver spoon. So if I can do it, I feel like anybody can do it. You just have to have that perseverance. And for me, it was a purpose-driven passion in my life. I didn't have money. I watched my parents not be able to make good choices for themselves in retirement because they didn't have the funds. So since then, my motto is, if you have money, you have a choice. If you don't have money, someone else will make that choice for you. I want my clients and I want to make the choice for me. Whether I make it or not is irrelevant. I want the money to make that choice.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And that's why I love working with you and sharing clients with you, because you have the client at the foremost of all decisions. You're not just trying to figure out, okay, how does Kimberly make the most money out of this transaction? And we were talking before we started airing just about a recent transaction that you had. And I love to hear those stories because I can tell that's where you're building your business. And I think that's why people flock to you because of that. So you give a lot of, or you get called on by MSNBC and Fox and all these networks out there and local networks here. I've seen you on, in fact, I just pulled one up this morning that you were on locally. You get called on to be a financial expert and to come on and talk about what's going on with the markets and what's going on with people's portfolios and different advice. What's the worst piece of financial advice you've heard over the years when you sit down with a client or you just hear it in the news that just, you just go, oh my gosh, I can't believe somebody actually said that.
Oh God, how can you just take one piece, Clint? I mean, you hear them just as much as I had. I mean, I had one story we were talking about before where a lady that came to me was a retired nurse and had about $1 million in her IRA. And her wealth advisor at the time recommended that she write put options, which I didn't even know you could do in an IRA, on oil stocks when the oil markets were just plummeting a few years back. I mean, it was ridiculous. And she just trusted him. And I think that's where people, because of the CPA, because the financial advisor is such an intimate part of your life, you don't really question it. It's like sex. People will talk about their sex lives more than they'll talk about their money life, right? I mean, out there. So, but it is a very intimate part of your life. So there's no reason to question that advisor. And I think that people need to question advisors if they don't feel it in their gut. This is the one thing I tell clients when they come in, or prospects, is like, look, whatever I explain to you about my philosophy and what it is, when you walk out of here, it should resonate in your gut. Like, okay, that makes sense. And she's after my best interest. If it doesn't, run away or say no. Don't go any further. But people need to trust their own guts as well. That would probably be right up there in one of the worst pieces of advice I think people have taken.
Yeah, that's a pretty bad one. I was telling you that I had a client that came to me and he had just purchased a $100,000 vehicle with his business because somebody had told him, hey, you get this tax write-off. And he did get a tax write-off, but it was about maybe a third of that. Maybe it reduces taxes by a third. Maybe it was 25%. I don't remember what the number was. He was still out like $75,000. And I said, can you afford a $75,000 car? And he said, well, no, but I got the $100,000 tax write-off.
Well, like, no, oh, you didn't.
Oh my God.
Yeah. I mean, this is where people just, I think they want to hear their selective listening. They want to hear what they want to hear. And then they go with that. And then you and I have to write that story and write the correct ending to the story. And then they're mad at us.
Right. You know, yeah. We're like Debbie Downer. We tell them that.
Exactly. Oh, no, I'm sorry. You can't do that. Yeah. It's like, no, that doesn't work that way. I know.
Yeah.
That's why if we can get to the clients ahead of time, and Clint, what I love about working with you is that way that we're so proactive about helping to educate our clients and then keep them on the right track. Most of my clients will, I mean, I would say probably 99% of my clients are educated, use that word, right? Educated enough to know that you got to check with me first to make sure that, not that I'm controlling, but to check to make sure that this is the right thing for your overall financial situation. And then I immediately go to you, the CPA, and say, hey, this is what they're thinking about doing. How's that going to be for their tax situation, right? Before I rebalance the portfolio or whatever, just like the common client that we have right now who potentially selling a business and like, okay, well, I don't want to do this rebalance if that's going to have an effect on them. So
right.
It's so critical to work together, being proactive.
Yeah. And that's what I tell my clients as well. If you have an advisor, we need to be talking, because otherwise you're getting advice from one side of the house and now you're comparing it to the other side of the house. You're trying to figure out who's the most trustworthy. Who has the best advice?
isn't that astounding? I always think that it just blows my mind. It's like, okay, the client, you're the owner of the team. We're the players, we're the receiver, we're the quarterback. This is us. We have to work together on your behalf.
Yeah.
Whenever I get a new client, I always send out a packet to a CPA or to the attorney or to the insurance and say, hey, they've just retained me as an advisor, looking forward to working with you on the team. Here's how we can work together. This is how I work, just so that you know, I'll never do anything. But from a tax expert, that's your job and that's your domain. And I'll always defer to you.
Yeah, that's critical. And I think that I think sometimes people get threatened by that, maybe. I don't know. I mean, really? I have had a few advisors. You were talking about bad advice. I've had a few advisors that gave really bad advice. And I unwound that a little bit. And then the advisor wasn't very happy with me. So it was
because you're probably second guessing him. Yeah. But if it's the wrong thing to do, it's the wrong thing to do.
Yeah. Yeah. It's right? tough. Yeah. I mean, that's why people come to us.
It's always the client first. And here's what my dad always said. Look, always look out for your client first. Do what's right for them and the money will follow. Yeah. If you put the money first, bad things are going to happen.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I've seen it time and again. Now, you deal with a lot of, obviously, we've talked about your clients, but you deal with a lot of wealthy individuals and you've helped build wealth for a lot of these individuals. What are some stories of just crazy generosity that you've seen from these folks?
You know, I think money begots more money, and the people that do have wealth, the reason they do is, again, it's not about the money. They're either the money, their money profile, their money story comes from when they're growing up, just like mine was. And that never changes, Clint. That doesn't change. Where I've seen things go sideways is where they're sudden money, right? They win the lottery I think I've had one client win the lottery, but they've gotten a settlement or what have you. Then I see things go sideways. But people who have really earned the wealth over time are incredibly generous. We have one client who committed to building basically a NICU in the area, expanding it by 10 times. And one of my employees had a cousin who had a baby who was in that NICU and was born only at 2 pounds. And NICU, it ended up saving the baby's life. And so it's like, it's a small world, right? So that commitment to pledging those monies over a period of 5 years to build that and expand that NICU actually saved one of my employees' family members, which is like amazing. So and the fact that they just did that, they just did it out of the kindness of their heart. They didn't have any, they weren't thinking, oh, we want our name up in lights and that kind of thing. I just feel like that's the kind of thing when you give back wealth, that's what you're doing it for. That's what God has said, right? We build ourselves, we take care of ourselves, then we take care of our family, then we take care of our community and our state. If everybody did this to that country, what amazing country we would have.
No, absolutely. Yeah, I love that. When you were talking about the folks who came upon wealth instantly, what are some things that they do to kind of torpedo their own future?
Yeah, so in the beginning, typically the experience that I've had with sudden wealth syndrome is that at first they're scared. They don't want to touch the money. They're just like, okay, no, this is not it. And then it either goes one way or the other. One way is they'll continue not to touch the money and their lives will kind of sort of remain the same. The other way is then they kind of see the wealth and they just, it's like floodgates just opened up. Like, they're buying $1 million properties, $2 million, $3 million properties, and just spending on a outrageous basis, right? That eventually they wake up, and this is what happens with athletes too, with the sudden money, is they wake up and then there's nothing there because they just got this $20, $30, $40, $50,000 a month going out. And if you've only got $10 million, that goes out pretty quickly. So I don't know if it's a mindset that people like it, kind of switches in their brain, like, I deserve this because of this event that happened. But what I try to do is exercise caution with them and say, okay, let's just be on a budget. This is this amount of money. Sometimes that works. Sometimes it doesn't work. It just depends on, I think, the money profile of people. And also sometimes the trauma that they went through to get that money.
Mm. Yeah. I could see that having a lot to do with it. I guess that kind of plays into one of the things we talked about before we hit record was, what do you see in people who have money that are happy versus people that have money and are miserable? What are the happy people or joyful people doing that separates them? Because obviously, if they're playing with the same amount of money, it's not the money. And we hear that often, right? Money doesn't make you happy. But for a poor person, they hear that and go, oh, I don't believe that at all. Because I don't have money and I'm miserable. So what do these happy, wealthy people do in their lives to get to that level?
I think it goes back down to the original focus of, if you focus on the money, then that actually stems from that allows you to look for money to basically, okay, I'm going to buy this car, that I'm going to be happy. It's going to fulfill it. Yes, for a moment it does, but then that goes away. That high goes away. That addiction sort of, that high goes away, that the money will fulfill that. The people that I see that are really genuinely joyful and happy are those who are grateful. I think they see this as an opportunity and they're grateful and they're thankful every day for the opportunities, and they give back. And they give back not counting, oh gosh, if I give this amount of money, then I get this tax break. Or if I give this amount of money, then I just don't want to make sure I, you know, keep my nest. It's like, it's almost a just an unconsciousness giving of self. And I think that's what brings joy to them. They're not worried about if the money will last or not. I mean, they're not stupid, just giving everything away. But I think that's the difference for joyful people and people who are just kind of like, they're, it's kind of like manure, right? It's like manure, right? If you have manure and you pile it up and it just stinks, right? Mm-hmm. So if you have a lot of money, you just pile it up, it just sort of stinks. And but if you spread it around, right, it does a lot of good for a lot of people. So that's a really probably
I love that
crude analogy, but it works, right?
The joy of manure. It's
the joy of manure. There we go. There I think go. We could do a podcast on that.
Right, exactly. So you've been on a lot of news networks and things. What are kind of the hot topics right now in the financial industry, and what should people be paying attention to?
You know, the hot topics are, yeah, of course, obviously the market is just insane. I've, you know, in 25 years doing this, I've never seen these kind of returns in my life ever. Nobody has. Although it's a very interesting, and as the Chinese say, may you live in interesting times. Well, I'd like it to be a little less interesting right now, right. Just, you know, a little less. But the markets are insane. And we've got the feds that are printing an absolutely insane amount of money to $7.4 trillion that went into the economy. We still have about $1 trillion sitting on the sidelines. So I do think this market, I mean, somebody has a gun to my head. This is my opinion. I don't invest on this, but I do think that this market is going to go higher. We may have some pullbacks, but it's going to go higher because we've just got all this cash. And money markets are not rewarding that. So it's going to go to the market or it's going to go to real estate. And we all know what's happened with real estate. But I think people really need to be cognizant of inflation. I really feel like this is a big issue. No one has seen it since the 70s. Most people alive today that invested didn't even know what inflation was. They were born after that and they haven't experienced it. But inflation is the number one, I think, detraction of wealth in somebody's portfolio. I mean, not even market crashes or divorces or anything like that. Inflation will absolutely kill your portfolio performance over time. So yeah. You really do need to be prepared for that.
Can you explain that a little bit? So if somebody's a millennial, they missed out on early inflation that you were talking about in the 70s and the crazy price increases. How does that truly impact their wealth building and their future in this?
Sure. Well, inflation is just about purchasing power, right? So if it costs us a buck for a loaf of bread today and the feds raise the cost of money to give to the banks, right? And right now, let's say the feds was at 1% and then the cost of money goes to, say, 3%. Then your cost of your bread may go to $4 a loaf of bread. So you have to have your money grow commensurate with that so that you can afford to buy that loaf of bread and not go into your principal, right? Mm-hmm. That makes sense. So you want to have, and why would the feds do that? Why would the feds raise from 1% to 3%? They do that because the economy is growing too fast. And the way that they control that is they raise the cost that they loan to the banks. So if they do that, it kind of contracts the economy and slows it down a little bit. So we don't get overinflation or hyperinflation like we did in the 70s. But for that in your portfolio, you want to make sure that the equity side of the portfolio has a significant exposure to things that can actually keep up with inflation, like banks can, because banks can raise money market rates, right? They can raise the cost of loans really quickly, right? Some food products, you can raise the cost of food products pretty quickly to absorb that, right? Consumer products, right? Industrials like lumber, you can raise the cost of that even though it's not a fixed cost. So you want to be in those kind of sort of value type of stock industry or some of the exposure to that to stay up with inflation. And on the other side, if you're fixed income, you definitely want to make sure that fixed income is shorter term, like 1 to 3 years in maturity, so that you can get those bonds out of the portfolio quick and get the newer, higher yielding ones in your portfolio.
That makes a lot of sense. Yeah, no, I'm glad you brought that up. It is really a critical topic. I think that one and the Biden tax plan are the ones that are scaring people.
Oh, yeah. I mean, do you know any? That's the thing. I keep hearing so many different things. I'm always consulting CPAs, you're like yourself, and asking like, okay, what's going on right now? Because the capital gains, that's the key, right? If we go to 28% in capital gains, either on a corporate or a personal level, that is going to absolutely come to a complete stop of selling securities or selling homes, right?
Yeah. Oh, yeah, for sure. Now, it just depends on where the income level is going to land on that. I've heard as low as $400,000 in AGI, and I've heard as high as $1 million. So I don't know which plan is going to get adopted. But I've got plenty of clients, and obviously you do as well, that have AGI over $400,000.
Oh, yeah. So
they're getting nervous because they're saying, well, should I sell my homes now? Because I can pay 15% on it now, or 20% max. But if I hold on to it, I'm going to pay ordinary income rates on it.
Right, right. And then what if they retroactively do that? That's what I've heard too, that they were going to retroactively make this. So people who are waiting, like I've got a couple of clients like, hey, well, why don't we wait until the Biden comes out with their tax plan and then maybe rebalance the portfolio? Well, you know, it might have already been because I've heard back to April of this year.
Yeah, that was what he came out and said when he released his plan, was that you should expect that this will be retro to April of 2021. But, you know, who knows? I mean, they literally changed the tax law in the middle of tax season this year for 2020.
Wow.
So I was in the middle of March and we started getting new changes from both the feds and the state on how they were handling stuff, mostly related to the Relief Act. But still, we had already filed, you know, 100 tax returns at that point, or 200 tax returns.
And then you have to go to amend those and change them again. I know. It's a dance, right? It's a dance. And we're all, and our clients are looking to us, but we're just trying to figure out basically where to step so that we don't step on a lot of toes.
Yeah, I posted something on Instagram and I got a little bit of backlash for it, but I said, be nice to your CPA, you know, because where you don't understand the changes that are going on behind the scenes that we just found out about. But yeah, it was
echo that. I do. I go, don't be upset at your CPAs because they're just trying to do the best that they can. Because it's ridiculous. I think they should have some kind of rule. I said, okay, like, you know what? We can only change at the end of December of 2021. You can't make any more changes. You can't make any more changes the next year that affects the prior year.
Yeah, you would think. But so, somehow you can do that. I told somebody, I said, it doesn't make sense to me why people get mad at their financial advisor, like vocally mad at their financial advisor or their CPA. Because if you think about it, if you call a plumber and they're fixing your plumbing, you don't stand over them and scream and yell at them because the water's still leaking, right? You want to step back, let them do their thing. And instead, I'm like, hey, I'm trying to do the best for you. And you're screaming, yelling at me, and you're not making me want to make you a priority right now.
I figure we actually need to have some experience in psychology too, so that we can combat that, right? So we don't have post-traumatic stress syndrome afterwards. Like some clients will call and you're like, oh, you see the name pop up and like, no, I don't want to pick up the phone.
I know. I don't have too many of those anymore. Okay. So I'm sure you get this question. Kimberly, what's one stock I should buy right now so that I can retire next year?
You know, if I had that answer, I would have my own island somewhere in the South Pacific, and I wouldn't be sitting here on your podcast right now.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Yeah. No, I understand.
But, you know, I do get this a lot. And obviously, my philosophy is a diversified portfolio exposed to different dimensions of the market, large cap, small cap, value, and high profitability. That's how we build the portfolios. But if you get only a few $1,000s or you want to just play something in your portfolio, I don't have any problem with taking 5 or 10% of your overall portfolio and playing it. And I get a lot of cyber secure, Bitcoin and like cyber,
cryptocurrency. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. All the time on that. But I'd say if I had a grandson, which I just had a grandson, so I have a grandson right now, which is just weird for me anyway. If I were to have one stock and put that in, let's just say a Roth IRA or something for him, I'd put Google in there.
Oh, just because of the way they're expanding and
they are, and they have no debt, and they have multiple lines of different products and services, and they're always expanding. I just feel like they have the global niche of most of the different areas in the market. They're touch on, at least.
Okay. Yeah, no, that's great. Didn't expect you to give me an actual stock, but that's great. I love it.
Yeah, I know. Everybody's like, but you don't invest in stocks. And I'm like, yeah, well, we do. We just do it through ETFs, right? You know, we do it through ETF funds and stuff. But that's the one thing. If you have a little one and somebody had a, you wanted to put money into some one particular stock, I mean, that's probably the one I would choose.
Yeah. So we get a lot of people who are building their business or starting out into something brand new or chasing their lifetime goal. What's advice you would give somebody who's just starting a business or just starting to turn a profit? What can they do at the age of 25 or so or 45 or whenever they started their business so that they can have some success down the road?
I think they really need to look at what their spending habits are and making sure that they have enough money on the sidelines. Make sure that your business has a reserve and that your personal life has reserve. Look at your spending habits and then start putting away into Roth 401ks, Roth IRAs as soon as possible. That money grows tax-free. It's going to come out tax-free. That is your, I think, your best bet of doing that. And then, of course, there's lots of tax strategies along the way. As you get older, you can do defined benefits and that kind of thing. But I mean, I think regular saving, early saving often, that's really the key. And I know that's hard when you start out with your business, but I started out with mine at 25 and I started out in a set for $25 a month. Then I increased it to $50 a month the next year, then $100 the next year. And then I pretty much was maxing out after about 4 or 5 years.
That's awesome. Okay. So we've got some great stock advice from you today. We got some very sage advice about how to build wealth smartly and to push through resistance and building a business. One of the questions I like to ask everybody is just from a resource standpoint, what are your three favorite books that you've come across and that you recommend to people?
Oh my gosh. A Random Walk Down Wall Street is a must in the, obviously, the financial industry. I really think that for new investors or just even sage investors, this is a great book for them to read. Atomic Habits is another one I really just started. I've read like twice that I really have enjoyed. And I think that helps to iterate just doing those little minor tweaks and doing those on a regular basis, you're going to create success and wealth in life. And you know, the last one is, that's always good. And I just find great wisdom in that is my Bible. Just reading the Bible on a regular basis. And sometimes in the book of Job, patience, faith, reward, like that's gotten me through so many difficult situations. I'm like, here's a guy who had everything, including his wife and his children, taken away from him. And I'm like, wow, I mean, my life doesn't seem so bad after reading the book of Job, right? So not to get all religious or anything on you, that, but it really does, for me, give me inspiration and wisdom.
Awesome. Love it. So A Walk Down Wall Street. Is that what it's called?
Random Walk Down Wall Street.
Random Walk Down. Okay. And then Atomic Habits and the Bible. Yep. I haven't picked up Atomic Habits yet, but I've heard great things about it.
It's a great book. I've read it twice now. I mean, I just keep going back and referencing and highlighting, and I just listen to it on audio as well, too.
Okay. Awesome. I'll pick that one up. Yeah. So great. Any parting shots that you want to tell our audience before we head out?
So your tolerance for risk is very different from another person's. And in this day and age right now, now people are getting back with parties. You're hearing a lot of stories of people who had a lot of success with one or two stocks or whatever. Don't get caught up in that wealth management or that wealth, you know, hoopla, where I call it investment pornography, because the bottom line is you don't know what the success over the long haul is for that person. And they're not going to share that with you. So you have to have an intimate plan for yourself of wealth creation and wealth maintenance. And that's with a good set of advisors like your CPA, your wealth advisor, an attorney. And, you know, listen to what they have to say. Pick those people wisely. Make sure that they're accredited. And don't get caught up in the noise around you. And there is a lot of noise. You and I are both on the media all the time. There is a lot of noise that is distraction and is just investment pornography. Leave it alone. Just listen to what your advisors know, what's the best course of action for you.
If nothing else, we got some incredible sound bites. We have investment pornography and what was it? The joy of manure, joy in manure. I can't remember how
many phrases. Joy in manure, right?
Yeah.
Right? Good. You got some Instagram shots there. Let's just do it.
That's great. Thank you so much for your time, Kimberly. This has been a really fun conversation. As always, if people want to contact you or follow you, how do they find you?
Instagram, Kimberly Foss CFP, and we're on LinkedIn or on Twitter, Kimberly Foss CFP, and then empyreanwealth.com, or you could go email me at Kimberly@kimberlyfoss.com. It's easy.
We'll have that in the show notes as well. But thank you so much for joining us. And
thanks so much for having me.
Yeah, this has been great. Hey, if you enjoyed what you heard today, please subscribe, share with a friend, and leave us a review. We love to get those, good and bad, because we like to learn from our mistakes. So we'd love to hear from you. If you want to catch up with my co-host, Parker Houston, who is not on today, you can go to his website, leadyoufirst.com, and you can sign up for his newsletter there. Until next week, keep climbing your next peak.